This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tong Phat.
I'm Mike Tatarski, a freelance reporter from the U.S. originally, but based in Ho Chi Minh City, where I've been for over a decade now. And I, in addition to international freelancing, write the Vietnam Weekly newsletter and host the Vietnam Weekly podcast.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all of...
What brought you to Vietnam originally?
Fairly standard origin story for, I guess, person from, with no Vietnamese background or heritage, obviously. So I studied political science and history in college, had a lot of interest in international affairs, wanted to work for the State Department, like the Foreign Service, and took that test, the people who work in embassies and consulates around the world. That didn't go anywhere. It's super competitive. And this was late 2010. My memory is a little fuzzy, but I think I basically Googled like ways to work abroad, and English teaching came up, and I found a program that did, it was like a 4-month ESL training program in Southeast Asia. So 2 weeks in Cambodia, and then you could choose to do your remaining 2 weeks, either there or in Vietnam or Thailand or Taiwan, a few other places. And basically, I'd seen Anthony Bourdain's shows at the time. I mean, again, that's a while ago. So I think it was when it was just No Reservations, kind of his first big show, and remain a huge fan of his. I think we're recording this a couple of days after his birthday, actually. And it was honestly as simple as, I was like, well, he seems to like it in his episode, so I'll give it a shot. And was going to come for a year in Ho Chi Minh City. And that was in, like I said, late fall of 2010. And so it lasted a little longer than that. But yeah, again, there was no real, I'll admit, when I arrived, I was pretty ignorant of the country. Had only eaten Vietnamese food once or twice. So there was no grand reason, though, other than curiosity.
And in the early days at 2010, you could have probably pivoted to other countries, being so close to all the other Asian countries, and traveling to Hong Kong or Manila or Taiwan. What made you decide to stay in Vietnam?
I will say I have traveled. I mean, it is easy to travel to a lot of those places. I haven't actually been to the Philippines, but most other neighboring countries very much so in the region. So travel was easy, but it was, easy probably doesn't sound quite right, but a relatively comfortable place to be. I mean, it was obviously 10, 12 years ago was still very much a developing place, but had most creature comforts you'd want. If you're coming from the West and kind of used to some of that stuff, but very much, an exciting place to be, very dynamic. Relatively quickly made a network of friends. And then also within that first year, kind of started getting interested in writing as well and started branching out into that space. And so just didn't really see or feel a need to leave because opportunities kept coming. And I mean, over the years, I've considered other locations and applied for jobs elsewhere, but have managed to stay here. So yeah, it's always been a interesting, exciting, certainly frustrating at times, but overall a really fascinating place to be.
We'll get into those frustrations, I hope. Love to hear it. And did you ever try to reapply to the State Department?
No, I mean, I think once I didn't make it past like the first round after that Foreign Service test in 2010, I think I was kind of just like, well, I'm not going to try that again. So I guess simple answer is no, I didn't really consider that again.
Yeah. And, I know you're a political science and history major, but making that sort of career switch gradually, what gives you the sort of the confidence to go into journalism, because it's a quite a different type of training that I feel like sometimes, I mean, I ask that from a very personal question, because people say, well, why don't you get into journalism, or have you thought about it? And I get pushed into it sometimes, but I think it's sort of, there's parameters to journalism that's very different from, you know, other industries that we can consider.
Yeah. I mean, yes and no, I suppose. I mean, and I guess, and certainly in, you know, 2024 now, I think, you know, the definition of journalism is a bit fluid, for lack of a better word. And I mean, it's certainly evolving given, you know, the rise of social media and all of that. I mean, some of it was certainly kind of, this phrase is a little overused, but I guess fake it till you make it. And I did kind of, I worked my way towards what I would consider, you know, to be actual journalism. Like, I mean, I started a blog when I moved here, but mostly just for friends and family, because, you know, in 2010, especially, no, very few people in the States really knew much. I mean, including myself, knew much about Vietnam beyond the war, obviously. So kind of just wanted to show people, you know, because I would have people ask me like, oh, do you like, you know, do they have cars? Like, do you live in a rice field? Nobody had any clue what urban, of course, this country has those things, but what urban Vietnam looked like. So a lot of it was just like, oh, I just want to show my friends and family back home kind of what it's like here. And people beyond that group, like, found it. And I mean, it is the internet, so it's out there, of course. And, you know, started complimenting me on my writing. And I don't remember any specific, like, who told me or anything, but like some people started urging me to move towards, or like give writing a shot. And I will say, I mean, studying poli-sci and history, of course, you don't do journalism per se, but you do write a lot. I mean, it's more, you know, essay type stuff. So I suppose that honed some sort of writing abilities. And then my first like writing job here was with a lifestyle magazine that doesn't exist anymore, aimed at other expatriates or you know, migrants. I know some people don't like the term expatriates. And that was pretty basic stuff, kind of, you know, restaurant reviews, you know, if I traveled somewhere, just writing about travelogue type stuff. And did that for a few years before an editor at a news organization reached out to me and assigned like what I would consider my first like real journalism story. So it took a few years of building up to that. So I did, you know, I guess this is kind of a rambling way of saying like there wasn't one day where it was like, I'm going to start doing journalism. It was very like a gradual thing over the course of several years. I will say none of it planned. I mean, again, it was kind of opportunity being here. Of course, it's not the easiest country for that line of work, but it is possible.
That's a definite thing that was on my mind when I started looking into your writing. It's fairly difficult to kind of stay within the lines of getting into hot water when you're covering such a sensitive country like Vietnam. It's to have that kind of longevity to stay there for over 10 years now and not what kind of brought you to understanding what you can say and what you cannot say when you're living in a country like Vietnam. As you're writing, because, you know, it's not a country in the world that, you know, is very open to free press, right?
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, so I'll say all this with the caveat that for foreigners, it's totally different than if you're Vietnamese. Like, there's, especially if you're writing in Vietnamese, I can't speak to that. I'm a white guy writing in English. For Vietnamese journalists, it can be quite risky and extremely challenging. I mean, you know, they could ruin your life if they felt like it. For foreigners, there's definitely a buffer, which I recognize is Maybe, I mean, there's obviously some unfairness in that, but that such is life. So there's that. There, you know, you are granted a bit of safety simply by being a foreigner. And then also over the years, I mean, reading, certainly within the last few years, as I've, you know, started the newsletter and that sort of thing, reading, consuming a lot of domestic media, of course, much of which is kind of state affiliated if, or state owned, and getting idea of what they are covering. And, you know, if they're talking about something, you can talk about it. I mean, sure, some of my writing will certainly go a little further in terms of analysis or adding context. But that's kind of my guidepost, I suppose. Like if there's something about a topic or an individual in state media, then that's kind of like an informal green light that, you know, you can at least write about it. And then, you know, kind of living here over the years, talking to people, other journalists and so on, that, you know, you learn that there's some topics that basically, I mean, really everyone should avoid writing about. And of course there is, this is kind of like anathema in journalism, but you have to practice self-censorship. Like it's just part of life, not just here and, you know, plenty of countries. So sometimes you just hold your tongue. And also you know, I'm fully aware that this is not, lived here for a while, but it's not my country. I'm not from here. So on the more political stuff, it doesn't really matter what I might think of something like that. And I suppose, you know, journalism is supposed to be objective anyway. So when it comes to those, I'm just not gonna have an opinion or not share it.
You know, I live in Vietnamese American society, and there is this constant nagging of we are outside, you know, as a Vietnamese American, we're the diaspora. And there's this quiet, sometimes loud online, but like kind of quiet understanding that you don't poke the bear, you know. You go back to Vietnam, you do the living as a tourist, and you hang out and you visit family. And there's these parameters that we have to, there's boundaries that we have to abide by. But, you know, what makes your life so interesting to me is the line that you have to straddle as an American journalist living in Vietnam, self-censoring what you can and cannot write. And as an American, we are free to write whatever we want to write when we're in America. But it's so fascinating when I think about your trajectory being in Vietnam, not as a trained journalist, but evolving over the years and figuring out what to write and what not to write. Can you describe that process of what you mentioned earlier about self-censoring?
Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
Yeah, I mean, some of it is as simple as like, you know, I know I'm friends with some diplomats here, and sometimes they'll know information before it gets reported in the media, and like, you know, they'll share that, like we're not having on the record conversations, but it'll be like, hey, did you hear this is going to happen? And I'll be like, okay, like we know it's confirmed basically, but that kind of information I will not publish or anything like that until it's in state media, because I mean, it, you know, there's no like regulation where it says like if somebody says this online before we confirm it, they will be kicked out of the country. But you just obviously don't want to like just find out where that line is. So certainly that sort of information. I mean, like I said, there are some topics like, you know, land disputes, ethnic minority issues. They're very interesting and important, but I don't, I'm not going to write about them. They're very sensitive. I mean, I'm sure, you know, plenty of the history there. So that's kind of more like just taking an entire topic out of even considering covering it or something like that. And then other, like I said, is a bit more information specific, where it's something that, you know, the state sort of hasn't made it public yet. So it's like, well, I probably shouldn't do that either. But I do want to say, like, it's, of course, it's challenging here. Obviously, it's not, there's no freedom of expression or press like in the States, but it is more, there's more criticism than I think a lot of people may think. Like, Vietnamese social media is pretty vibrant. I mean, Facebook is massive. Places like Twitter aren't quite as popular here, but there's a lot of kind of surprising stuff being said on social media. And of course, you know, I'm sure someone could get the police at their door in minutes if somebody decided that it was their turn to get in trouble or something like that. But it's not, I don't want to overstate it and make it sound like nobody, you know, ever says anything that is a little bit critical of what's going on. And I mean, even state media can be pretty critical of certain issues sometimes as well. Obviously people can't get in trouble in a hurry.
I recently went on another podcast, and it was a Vietnamese American podcast in Vietnamese. And I said that, you know, I brought up a lot of things about, you know, it's very shallow things about living in Vietnam. Prices are cheap. You know, there's a lot of luxury things that are sometimes even more luxurious than the United States. In some circumstances, people are living like better lives than people in America. And I got roasted for being on this podcast. Oh. And I got like seared over like open flames by the comments. And I'm like, it got to a point where it was unbearable because of, and I think there's maybe the thumbnail that was created, you know, that was on, I was on Sean Lay's podcast, and, you know, he's a conservative podcast host. It was a great time. He and I have a wonderful relationship, but I got roasted because there is this sentiment that the government is so closed. It is, you know, there are so many comments were like, go back to Vietnam and live and see how you still feel. I've been back to Vietnam every year, anytime from one time to four times. You know, it's a lot. I have a brother who lives there. I pay attention to what you just said about people. I feel like sometimes people in Vietnam have more power to change their lives in terms of, I wouldn't say pressuring the government, I would say being loud. And it also seems to me like the people in Vietnam and the government in Vietnam are sort of, they're kind of working in a weird simultaneous way with each other. It's just not like the system in the United States. And for me, it's often analogous to how we in the Vietnamese families are top down. And I make this kind of analogy with friends of mine, where I feel like the Confucian system, the respect, the filial piety, everything's top down. You don't disrespect your parents. You don't disrespect uncles and aunts and your grandparents. And I feel like that kind of authoritarian sort of feel in China, Vietnam, and all these countries that have Confucian backgrounds is sort of rooted in the way our culture is set up. And the way the American culture is set up is like, it doesn't matter who your parents are or your people who are older. If they're doing wrong, you just speak up. And, you know, so I think it's very embedded in our minds that it's a hierarchical way. And I think the government is sort of set up that way, but there are ways that the government is changing when they listen to the will of the people. I mean, can you give me some insight about that? Am I far off here?
I don't think so. I mean, yeah, obviously I can't really speak to the, kind of that way of upbringing, since I'm obviously had a very different upbringing, but there is, And I guess I'm not surprised that, you know, I know there's certain corners of, well, certainly the Vietnamese American community. I know there's understandable historical grievances towards Vietnam, contemporary Vietnam. Although I'm not going to, I don't think I need to get into that. But certainly there is, I mean, yeah, of course it's a top-down system, but there are certainly times where, you know, public opinion matters.
Right.
I mean, it may not be voiced in, you know, a national election or something like that. I mean, over the last decade, there have been a couple instances of kind of like mass protests that were pretty impactful. That's very rare. So, you know, maybe we won't count that. But, you know, environmental policies are sometimes, if not protested against, you know, there will be loud voices in on social media or even, you know, state newspapers have like, they run opinion pieces sometimes. I mean, of course, they're not just going to run it from anybody, but you do see, you know, dissenting voices. Even in coverage of the National Assembly meeting, sometimes, you know, that's kind of often presented as like a rubber stamp organization, but you know, assembly members do sometimes question ministers or law proposed laws, that sort of thing. So there is some responsiveness. I mean, I guess the kind of most I saw it firsthand was during COVID. We had a really hard lockdown here in Ho Chi Minh City in late, I'm losing track of the years, 2021, 22, yeah. No, 22, or no, 21, sorry. And, you know, I'm in a group chat on Zalo, like the kind of the national messaging app here. And I was using a lot of Google Translate, but like the ward leader or local official is in the chat. And of course, you know, they're not going to respond to everything, but if people complain, they'll at least be like, okay, well, we can talk about, this very local issue. So, you know, there is local low level, street level, I guess, interaction between the people and their officials. And yeah, I mean, national level policy changes, you might not see that too frequently, but certainly at lower levels of government, they can be pretty responsive if displeasure is kind of shown in I guess like a, you know, acceptable way.
Yeah, I've noticed that. And it surprises me sometimes when I come across it. I can't remember any specific instances, but I'm like, whoa, you know, there is a sort of weird way to contribute to change. And it's done in a sort of respectful way sometimes, or it's done in perhaps a proper channel. But there are ways that I think that Vietnamese Americans are, we can't see it. We want to see it. We want to know more about it. But oftentimes you got to really be glued to the street social media scene or whatnot. And it's, I think it's frustrating for a lot of our elders in America to not be able to see it, but it's just a different system. And I'm strangely fascinated by it because I feel like we exist in a completely different world than, you know, like my brother lives in Vietnam 20 years and he's having a wonderful life with his family, but you know, he's not involved in politics and he's not, you know, part of any dissenting, you know, body or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're right when you kind of started this thread that there are, I mean, granted, if you have the privilege of having money, but a lot of Vietnamese, you know, it's funny because sometimes the foreigners here, some people still have the image of like them being the ones with a lot of money. And of course, there are some foreigners here who are quite wealthy, but the really wealthy Vietnamese like have, you know, have astronomical amounts of money that like no foreigner here will ever even come close to. Yeah. You know, of course, there's inequality. There isn't in any country, but yeah, you're right. And I'm always struck by I can't quantify it. Maybe it's a little more prevalent here in southern Vietnam, but like the entrepreneurial spirit of Vietnamese is incredible. And I've had older family members in the States ask like, oh, you know, what's it like living in a communist country? And I'm like, well, for the most part, I couldn't really tell you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because there's so many, small businesses. And I always think of, this is like a very tiny example, but there'll be the woman on the side of the road selling banh mi. And as soon as it starts to threaten to rain, suddenly she'll be selling ponchos. Like everyone's got a side hustle to their side hustle. And this is a bit of a tangent now, but like my younger Vietnamese friends, like they switch jobs like frequently, where, in the States, it's like, if you lose your job, that's like pretty devastating most of the time. And I've had friends who was just like, oh, I quit my job. And I was like, you've been there for like 6 months. And it's like, yeah, well, I'll find something else. And then they usually do pretty quickly. I mean, these are, younger, well-educated people. But yeah, it's I kind of lost track of my train of thought here, but
yeah,
but I think it is much different than what a lot of people probably expect.
Yeah. That's an interesting point you bring up. I think that ability to kind of like jump jobs has something to do with the family structure as well, because I think in America, when you're 18, you're expected to leave the house. And I think mm-hmm. in Vietnam, even when you get married, your parents want you to stay at home and be with them, bring your wife or bring your husband and live with them. And then so if you're kind of coming up in Vietnamese society and you need to jump ship from a company, you really don't have to worry about rent. You don't have to worry about how you're going to support yourself out in the street, because you're living at home. And it's such mm-hmm. such a different system.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure many of your listeners are aware, but multi-generational households are still very common. I mean, slowly fading a little bit in some ways, but I guess as a side, you see articles. So there's one news outlet here, VN Express, that runs a lot of sometimes pretty tawdry, but like, I guess a reader will like send in a question of like, what do I do with this situation? And they'll get comments. And a lot of it is stuff like, how do we tell our in-laws that we don't want to live in their house anymore or something like that? Or, stuff in the States, we'd be like, why on earth would I be living with my parents or let alone in-laws, but it's pretty common here.
Yeah. And I think that's shifting in the States too. A lot of families, are doing the second, third generation all in one house vertical, it's happening. And I think it's for the good. I think, staying with parents until you're, married and bringing your spouse in, I think that's a good cultural thing that, but I think Vietnam's changing the other way. It's, it's adopting to a little bit more freedom inside family structures.
Yeah. I mean, that it's interesting. And cause in so many ways, Vietnamese society is, I'm hesitant to say westernizing. I guess we could say internationalizing, since it's not all about the West, but certainly there's a lot of aspects, even with things like urban planning. And I know that is not really related to families, but that seemed to be kind of modeled, or if not copying, a lot of what is, you and I have seen in the States or other developing countries. And some of these countries are now like, hey, maybe this wasn't the best idea. We should like try something else or go back to a different way. Whereas some people here are like aspiring to these things that other countries are starting to turn away from, which is just an interesting,
evolution.
Again, not directly related to families, but an interesting stage in development of all these places.
What are some of the most notable changes that you've witnessed from 2010 to the present day living in Vietnam?
Of course there's the obvious, like there's way more tall buildings and bridges and stuff like that. But certainly Ho Chi Minh City is like extremely internationalized. Not citywide, like there are districts where, you won't see many kind of the core districts, there's food from all over the world, there's people from all over the world. I don't just mean tourists, like residents working here. And that, again, that, I mean, Hanoi has that to an extent, but the diplomatic community is bigger there, and for example, but Ho Chi Minh City feels certainly much more international than Hanoi. So that, that's a big one. Kind of the, I guess sometimes a little, maybe I'm unfortunate, but this kind of like flattening of global culture, which is kind of happening everywhere, where we all have similar, you know, third wave coffee cafes and nice restaurants, which I enjoy going to those places. Sometimes you're like, well, this could be almost be in any city. So I didn't mean for that to sound negative. I mean, certainly the international food, international cuisine is amazing. Obviously Vietnamese food is fantastic, but just the availability of especially Japanese and Korean, for example, like those two countries are huge investors here, both private investment and like the government, you know, government aid. So yeah, certainly more international. And I mean, it's gotten easier to travel around the country. You know, of course our infrastructure struggles, but you know, there's way more highways than there used to be. The roads by and large are pretty good. So you can get to, you know, pretty rural areas, relatively comfortably.
This is Scott Campbell from the Stupid Things for Love podcast. I have a 7-year-old son, and the biggest mountain I climb every day is trying to put shoes on this child. And I'm so grateful to Skechers for making the only shoes my son will willingly put on by himself. Their slip-ons are amazing, and he doesn't have to deal with laces. He doesn't have to deal with anything. They come in the perfect color blue. Thank you, Skechers, the comfort technology company. And you can find Skechers everywhere, Skechers.com, a Skechers store, or wherever stylish footwear is sold.
I feel like these aren't very good answers, but...
Well, I mean, I'll get into something that I remembered. I was listening to a podcast, the Vietnam Weekly podcast that you hosted. It was like 2 or 3 episodes ago. And, you know, typically I do write it in my notes and then I repeat the names to bring reference to it. But the thing that I do remember, the term that I do remember is PCI. And it's an index that this professor or this researcher, you know, 20 years ago came. And you and him, I forget his name. I forget the whole name of the podcast episode. My apologies.
No, that's right.
So if you can refresh my memory, but I'll get into the question if you can really just quickly kind of bring that up real quick.
Yes, that was with Eddie Molesky. He's a professor at Duke. He's based in the States, but has been he's like a renowned Vietnam expert. And yeah, played a major role in creating this PCI or Provincial Competitive Index, which annually surveys Vietnamese businesses around the country to kind of get an idea of how they feel about business environment, government regulations, all that at a provincial level. So that's what that was about.
My apologies. I'm reading and listening so much to you and, you know, just, and I'm making jotting notes. And so I completely forgot. I was like with my kids that one day. So these kinds of things interest me so much. And it interests me because when I ask you about the changes and then you're like, oh, you know, I don't know if I've answered it, but it's the craziest thing is like you go down and you drill down into the details with Eddie on this podcast. And it is really important for Vietnamese Americans to know that 20 years ago, Eddie goes back and finds this, stumbles upon this bright idea to create this index called the PCI. And what's so fascinating to me about this is like the provinces that are, you know, in competition to change, to get business, to drum up their numbers. And there's corruption, there's all of these factors that is in this index that shows the improvement over time is actually being watched very carefully by somebody. And it's brought up in the government and it's brought up and respected as a number for outside investment. And I think that when I hear it, I'm like, oh my God, here's something that is qualifying these little places around the country, and they're all in competition to do better on an international standard level. And so when I think about the progress of Vietnam, and what I'm excited about is to see provinces compete with each other for business. And this index done by Eddie Molesky is It is changing the internal engine of business. And so I really advise our audience to listen to your podcast, because you go really deep into all of these types of subjects. So if you could share with me a little bit about that index that we're talking about right now and the change over time that's projected for Vietnam.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Eddie, his work is fascinating. And I'm sure he would want me to give credit to the many researchers who help him with the work. Some of that is, which I suppose that this also goes to the question of some of the bigger changes over time. And I think something that's been a bit documented in the PCI in some ways is kind of the rise of like Northern Vietnam as kind of this like new industrial center for the country. So, which we do talk about in the podcast, how when they launched it 20 years ago, like Binh Dinh was always one of the highest performers. Da Nang, I know that's not in Southern Vietnam, but that was kind of early on a high performer. These provinces around Ho Chi Minh City, and including Ho Chi Minh City, kind of were at the forefront of attracting footwear, garments, textiles, furniture, those sorts of industries, all of which are still here and very big. But now you have the North emerging as where most of the tech, Samsung, most of their factories are there. Foxconn has a bunch of factories up there. Usually when people from NVIDIA or Apple come visit, they're looking up north. Of course, that is where the government is. So if they're meeting ministers, that makes sense as well. But Quang Ninh province has come in first in this index, I think six or seven years in a row. So that's kind of like definitely a sign that there's, this a bit of an economic shift underway, I hope, the southern region remains just as vital, but clearly there's a lot of economic activity and investment happening in the north. Something else that I found really instructive from our conversation in the PCI was how, so of course, I'm sure some of your listeners know there's been this anti-corruption campaign going on here. There's a lot of a lot of coverage of it domestically. There are some concerns about where it's gone, I suppose. And it raises questions of, what does it mean for low level, street level corruption, I guess. And Eddie, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but it's like quantified that significantly fewer businesses report now that they have to pay bribes than did in 10 years ago. They have to, set aside less of their annual revenue for informal charges is the phrase they use. Of course, those numbers are still too high. I mean, any corruption is
too much.
You don't want that in an ideal world in any country. But like, it's quantified that, and these are Vietnamese businesses reporting without oversight from, officials in their province or whatever. And it's had an impact, that's really important. And kind of surprisingly, not something, the PCI gets covered, but that kind of seems like those figures in particular seems like something that should be kind of like front page news here.
Yep.
And hasn't really been. So, anyway, it's a fascinating report every year. And I think, I know not everyone is going to want to sit down and open up like an 80-page report, but can definitely give some insights that for many people, or myself included, are, kind of missing, given the like more restricted media atmosphere here.
Yeah. And what frustrates me most about being part of the Vietnamese American diaspora sometimes is that we don't look at these significant reports, and we are not aware that there are people on the ground doing these sorts of, it's non-political. But at the end of the day, it becomes political if you think of it as political, but it's not. It's just hard numbers. And it's a presentation that the landscape of business is paying attention to where to put their investments. And the international world of NVIDIA or Apple and Foxconn going back to Vietnam, doing business, doing their due diligence, looks at these reports. And I think as a whole, we in the outside, on the outside, are not like, we're not penetrating these sorts of actions on the ground that are like creating substantial change. Because people in Vietnam, the government of Vietnam wants these outside investments to come in. And these powerful corporations that come in have to look at where they want to put their factories and want to base their headquarters in Vietnam. And so this is very significant to me, because it's not like, we are not living in the Stone Ages where you know, data is not available. Data is available, and it's being the data is being cultivated in a very academic and, you know, apolitical way, not political. It's just, here are the facts, and big companies will come back and throw money down to kind of invest in this country that we, you know, for the most part, you know, the first generation in America are, you know, they're just not paying attention to it. And I want the listeners, the young listeners that are in the diaspora, to kind of tell their parents that, you know, there are significant changes, you know, and we'll get into the climate and you know, the climate conversation with you too. But there are these seismic shifts that are happening on the ground in Vietnam that most of us are not being, you know, tuned into.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, again, it shows how, I mean, of course our huge problems, but the governments can be responsive. I mean, I know Eddie was, I remember he said how he was struck when, I think the first time they did the index, they left out several provinces because they were worried about, I think some in the Central Highlands, for example, because they were worried about sensitivities about going to some of these areas with historical tensions. And then the next year, the provinces were like, why didn't you include us? We want to be in this. Wow. And so then now, I mean, every province like happily, maybe happily is overstating it, but takes part. You know, some provinces have kind of created their own version of this to track their own performance. Other provinces have kind of like banded together to share best practices that they're learning from each other.
Wow.
So I realize when you look at the, you know, kind of the broad news and it's just like corruption scandal after scandal, you're like, well, this just looks like a mess. I mean, I'm not saying it's not a mess in some ways, but there is like these more granular reports. Again, I know not everyone wants to sit down and read a huge report, but there is real change happening. Of course, it's, you know, slow and sometimes it's two steps forward, one step back or whatever, but there's very interesting work happening.
Yeah. I mean, you and Eddie get into the weeds, and it's fascinating to hear how this PCI index had evolved over the years and the kind of things that are being looked at. It's it creates this sort of sense of that, you know, whatever we think is whatever the Vietnamese government wants to do, at the end of the day, there's these market forces that, you know, everybody wants to kind of improve their chances of bringing these investments into their provinces. And provinces are sort of analogous to states. Would that be a safe thing to say?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so provinces, like states in America, wants defense contracts, wants Amazon to come in, wants big business to be in their regions. And so if you're competing for the outside money, you shape up and you do better and you want to prove to the world that, you know, our state, our province is a worthy place to do business. And then that in itself creates improvement for lives of Vietnamese citizens.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, I mean, there's some real correlation. I mean, like I said, Quang Ninh has led this index multiple years in a row, and they, like, the VinFast factory is there. There's a lot of foreign, VinFast is Vietnamese, but a lot of foreign tech companies have factories there. They opened a big international port a couple years ago. So there's clearly some like one-to-one correlation there between better performance by the provincial government and investment, which in theory, at least, will improve local livelihoods.
Yeah. And I'm always for the kind of quiet change. I'm for the market forces forcing, you know, ways of thinking in Vietnam, because, you know, we can't bang the drums here and demand certain changes from a very superficial outside point of view. It really requires like these big lumps of power change coming in from the outside and saying, well, look, we have this money. It changes lives. It changes people on the ground. And, you know, and when these smaller provinces or bigger provinces make decisions to do right, it creates sort of decades of goodwill and legacies of business staying in Vietnam and for the local governments to do the right thing and to make sure that, you know, bad actors are prosecuted.
Mm.
And so, it's just, you know, I just getting roasted for me, I think I'm feeling the sting of getting roasted from that last podcast, you know, and I'm like, there's so much happening in Vietnam that we don't get to talk about. And so here we are, you know, and I really want to push our audience to really listen to the Vietnam Weekly podcast hosted by yourself. And you go deep into these topics. And I think it's, you know, I don't, my podcast is very different. You know, we have conversations. Yours is very, you dive deep into these subjects, and it's important that most of us are informed about the changes that are happening in Vietnam.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. I mean, hoping the episodes, I mean, I hopefully learn as much as anybody else from the episodes and the guests. But I appreciate the kudos.
Yeah, I'm a fan, and you know, I'm gonna, you know, try to get through all of them too, because, you know, it gives me you know, a lot of information. And you know, we talked jokingly earlier about guest exchanges and referrals to each other. You know, I would love to offer that to you, and hopefully that I can bring guys like Eddie onto my podcast to kind of open up this topic as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you wrote a piece back in November 2022 about the growth. You wrote the growth outpacing the rate of development, and it was part of the headline, and I thought that was a very interesting thing. And if you really break it down, if you really think about it, yes, there's functions to the way we understand growth, and there's a difference in development. And can you talk about the dangers of growth outpacing the rate of development in Vietnam and what that means?
I think this it's kind of a common tension in a lot of fast growing countries. And I will say I don't have like a scientific definition of those two things, but I guess for the purpose of the conversation, I'm considering growth to be like GDP growth, and then development to be the, you know, attendant building roads and airports and metro lines and all that stuff. So we're seeing a lot of that, a lot of issues with that here in Ho Chi Minh City, certainly. I mean, it's been for quite a while now the economic center of Vietnam. There are kind of some serious concerns about, you know, whether what kind of growth it'll be able to sustain moving forward, given its challenges. But there's a ton of economic activity here, you know, flashy new high rises and expensive apartments. And that, you know, we kind of mentioned the fancy restaurants and Rolls Royces and all that stuff. But we don't have a functioning subway system. One line has been it's like comically delayed at this point. Maybe it'll open this year. The airports, you know, overcrowd. If you visit, you know, how it's not the most pleasant place. Traffic's getting worse. It's not like apocalyptic by any means, but you know, more people can afford cars, so there's more car traffic than there used to be. Certainly when I moved here, you know, there's environmental flooding and waste collection and pollution problems, and that, you know, these are not unique challenges to Vietnam, but that's where, you know, setting aside one or two bad pandemic years, you know, by and large hitting 6%, 7% GDP growth for the last 10, 15 years. There's just a lot more money floating around, but it takes longer, certainly as we're seeing here, at least to build the infrastructure that kind of you need to support that growth.
But you see that kind of problem in Mexico City. You see it in Bangladesh. You know, these are that I've been through. You know, you're moving like a mile and it takes 3 hours in traffic, and it's just absurd. Vietnam is not quite at that level yet, but it can get to it, right?
Yeah, and that's one of my real concerns. I mean, if you read my newsletter, I touch on infrastructure relatively frequently, and there's real, like, I mean, I mentioned the metro line. It's been under construction since 2012. They haven't started a second one. Hanoi is a little bit ahead. They have one that's been open for a couple of years now. And I think they're opening part of their second line this month or soon. Hanoi also has more highways, you know, going out to some of the neighboring provinces. But yeah, they're, you know, so Ho Chi Minh City at least is looking at probably the mid-2030s with going into the mid-2030s with one functioning metro line, unless something dramatically changes, which we're not seeing evidence of that, sadly. It's going to be tough if Ho Chi Minh City is, you know, going into the mid-2030s with one functioning metro line. I mean, the unofficial population, I think, is easily over 10 million at this point. Yeah. You know, in another decade, it'll probably be closer to 15, you know, million at the least, especially if kind of internal migration from the Mekong Delta continues like it has been, since that has obviously huge climate related problems. I mean, I totally agree. Ho Chi Minh City is not, it's not Manila, it's not Jakarta or something like that. We're not seeing, the pace of that kind of development isn't matching with like the economic dynamism or the you know, the economic growth story that is commonly told about Vietnam.
Yeah. But it's very difficult to address this development and growth kind of ratio, because, you know, as evident in what we're just talking about, Jakarta, you know, Manila, Mexico City, Bangladesh, you know, many governments fail to keep up with this ratio, and it's a problem. And especially, you know, what you brought up with climate and conservation issues, there's even, I think, more of a practical issue with the Mekong. This is what I've heard, that upstream in the Mekong, I mean, it's China, right? Controlling the waterways down into the Mekong. And I think the pressure, and this is something that, you know, I haven't heard much about, but maybe you could, if you do, or if you know a little bit about it, I've heard that the neighbors to the north, China, is playing around with the control of the waterways into the Mekong. And if that's being controlled, that whole area, like all up and down Vietnam, is going to suffer tremendously in terms of living and depending on the waterways of the Mekong.
Yeah, I mean, the deltas are really, it makes me sad, because it's an incredible part of the country. The food's great. The people are really friendly. It's just like visually fascinating. And there's a lot of different, given the history, a lot of different, you know, there's Cham people and different types of temples and all that. But yeah, it's, I mean, the long-term future is pretty terrifying. And I mean, in part, you're right. You know, there's all these upstream dams in China's, within China, on their stretch of the river. Several have been built in Laos and Cambodia as well. I mean, I should also say there's Vietnam has built some dams on tributaries of the river as well, which certainly doesn't help. And then there's also other issues within Vietnam, like sand mining, groundwater extraction. So it's a mix of external issues and internal, and then kind of looming all over all that is climate change and sea level rise. You know, every year saltwater from the tides kind of goes a little further upstream into the delta. And, you know, if you're growing rice, you can't grow that if there's salt in the water, or not much at least.
So
it's a mix of internal and external. And yeah, I mean, China can kind of control the flow of water a bit, although the bigger issue is actually that all these dams trap massive amounts of sediment that otherwise would be flowing down the river. And so there's all of this sand mining happening within Vietnam, also in Cambodia, construction.
What is sand mining?
So it's like there's barges with big cranes on them, and they just drop a claw thing into the river and then pull sand out from the bottom. Or I think there's also boats that basically just have like giant vacuums, for lack of a better word, giant hoses that just suck sand up from the bottom of the river. And some of it's legal, a lot of it's illegal, but it's used for either like filling in land where you want to build. Singapore, for example, has a really bad hit record of taking sand from mainland Southeast Asia to expand. So you have the sand mining happening for construction and land reclamation. So basically that's getting taken out of the rivers, and there's not sediment coming down the river to replace it. And this allows, some of this might be a big technical, but basically allows more salt water to come upstream over time. So from my understanding is that the sediment is actually the bigger problem than the water levels, at least. It's a huge problem. Some of it is of Vietnam's own making. A lot of it isn't. You see these projections where by 2050 or something, most of the delta could be underwater at high tide. And that would be just a complete disaster for Vietnam and the world, really, because it's a huge rice export area, and aquaculture, fruit, you name it, is grown down there. And not to mention, of course, the like 18 million people currently living there. So that's scary. I'm personally quite fascinated by the Delta, but very concerned about it. I know a lot of people are.
When I think about this stuff in the Delta happening and sand mining and the world of these 18 million people are going to gradually perish, it sounds like. How many people, and I don't mean in terms of quantity, but is there a big force of activists or people in the government really paying attention to fixing this? Or is it something that, sand miners are just coming in and, you know, the money's right and there needs to be an export of all this stuff and it's just the Wild Wild West?
In terms of activists, I will, civil society here, I know I've been positive about some things, but the civil society situation here is poor, to put it mildly. There's been a crackdown in the last few years, kind of particularly in people working in the environmental space, which is concerning. There are some efforts to crack down on the illegal sand mining aspect. Last year there was a big scandal in, I think, Anzhan province, where I think the province chairman, or at least several pretty high level provincial officials, were arrested for taking bribes to allow illegal sand mining. It does get covered in state media pretty frequently, which is a good sign. I mean, it means it's something that, you know, Vietnamese journalists can cover to some extent, at least. In terms of real enforcement, I've seen articles about You know, journalists will like be recording sand miners working at night, and then morning comes around, they leave, and then the police come, and you know, the mining is done. So there's not like the people have already left, and that doesn't get handled. So yeah, it's a challenging issue. I mean, there are, it's not just like a complete free for all as some of the like official arrests we've seen have indicated. But it's a definitely a difficult issue to address.
Well, Mike, I you know, in closing, I really think that you and I are just touching really superficially all these topics, and I hope to have you back on the podcast more often. And I hope that this is a start to a relationship that we can exchange, you know, freely what goes on in Vietnam. And, you know, if you ever have any urge to, you know, come back with new topics, and I know we're just scratching the surface here. And sure. Again, you know, in terms of guests, you know, coming back and forth on our shows, I really believe in the podcast medium, because we can really have a lot of freedom to kind of talk about whatever we want and go in many directions. Mm-hmm. And I think that unlike other businesses, the podcast business is dependent on collaborating with each other. And so, yeah. You know, I really make an emphasis with all my sisters and brothers in the podcast community that we work together. And so I just want you to let you know, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast today.
Oh, I appreciate you having me on, and enjoy this. And yeah, we'd be happy to come back on, and I'll be sure to plug your show on mine as well. Cause I agree. I mean, you know, people collaborating is really important in this format.
Yeah. It's a very different medium than other, you know, businesses. You know, it's competitive in other businesses, and you want to kind of, you know, keep to yourself and just kind of keep plugging along and doing your product. But I think in podcasts, it's different. It's because, you know, that collaborative effect brings this sort of amplification to the hosts and the shows. And the more we have each other on each other's shows, the collaboration creates a very amplified effect. So thank you.
Yeah, totally agree. Oh, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
Wayfair's Labor Day clearance is back. Now through September 3rd, score up to 70% off everything home. Plus, end summer with can't-miss surprise flash deals. Because at Wayfair, new season means new savings. Like up to 70% off rugs, up to 50% off bedroom furniture, up to 60% off kitchen essentials, and up to 50% off dining furniture. All with fast shipping right to your doorstep. Shop Wayfair's Labor Day clearance now through September 3rd for up to 70% off.
Wayfair. Every style, every home.